Today we're going to talk about cattle, and I'm willing to bet that after this conversation you'll look at cows differently, and I think more appreciatively. Consider this. These massive and generally placid animals have done more than accompany human social development over the ages. They've influenced the evolution of language, culture, and commerce in profound ways. More than just a food source, cattle have helped define the pace of gender definition and the very course of national development. Above all, our complex relationships with these great beasts reminds us that we do not dominate nature, but exist interdependently with it. My guest today is Lori Wynn Carlson, author of Cattle, an Informal Social History, published by Ivan R.D. Lori, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for coming. And I will go out on a limb and characterize your book as a book of surprises to readers who normally don't think about cows. I guess I normally haven't done as much as I should. And the surprises start right from the beginning. You take us back 15,000 years into the caves of Altamira, Spain, and by extension, Lascaux, France, where I think you call it Cows on the Ceiling, where there's wonderful paintings of cattle I think we've all seen. But I think you make a very important point here, that those paintings, which are really quite extraordinary, don't depict cattle as prey, nor really as deities, but rather, I'll use this expression, rather as fellow beings. Is that right?
Well, that's what it appears. It appears that they were not creatures to be eaten. They were not worshipped as such. They seem to be like, I kind of think of it as an IMAX theater of cattle behavior. Because they were painted most likely for public display. And, yeah. And the area they were in was a large area for a gathering of people. And it really appears to be that someone was showing other people how cattle behaved, that this was either a topic of discussion among a group, or mm-hmm. someone was perhaps lecturing, or as I said, sort of an IMAX three-dimensional artistic representation.
I think that description is very, very apt. I mean, as you describe this to the reader, you give us a real sense of the sophistication of those paintings. I mean, the techniques sound very painstaking. And by doing that, Lori, you give us two additional things. A greater appreciation of the sophistication of our ancestors all those many years ago. They just weren't rude, rough brutes, it doesn't seem at all. And also that this relationship between cattle and human was probably much more complex right from the start than we might have thought.
Well, that's what it appears, that these the paintings were probably made to represent cattle behavior. Mm-hmm. They seem to be showing people how the cattle behaved in a herd, mm-hmm. the different types of activities that they engaged in. And also when these paintings were discovered, what I found fascinating doing the research was how reluctant people were to accept this, that these had been done by ancient peoples.
That's right. That's very well documented. I think the Spanish discoverer went to his grave without being given the credit for what
right.
he'd come up upon.
Yeah.
You then, of course, take us into the period following that where cattle did become objects of mystery and of religion. And I mean, I guess many people are familiar with the cults, everything from Crete with the Minotaur and the ceremonies to, I guess, the Egyptian god Horus. Was he the cattle-headed god?
She was.
She was. Yeah. An important
the
distinction.
The mother of
right.
the Milky Way or something.
Right.
Yeah.
But this whole long era of mystery, Lori, I got a sense from you, came to an end with domestication. Is that right? When we began to domesticate cattle?
What I've discovered is it's so foggy. We're just not quite sure where mm-hmm. they were domesticated first, or not quite sure where they were milked first, and not quite sure exactly how it happened. So mm-hmm. we're trying to piece this together, and it looks like it's a very hazy part of history, but we mm-hmm. kind of came together. I think the cattle probably had as much agency as the humans did.
Yeah.
And that's what it appears from the way their behavior coincides with humans.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were both kind of along the same waterways. They were in the same climatic zones, and they just kind of enjoyed being with each other.
I really like that expression you just used. The cattle had as much agency as humans. And so I guess the question to you is this, Lori. From their side of the co-adaptation with humans, do they essentially integrate us or incorporate us into the herd, so to speak, or find some way of dealing with humans based on what how they deal with themselves?
Well, I think because of the way a herd operates, there's sort of an authoritarian, or not an authoritarian, but a hierarchy within the herd, and who they will follow is, you know, they choose their own followers
right.
when they can. When they're forced to move by humans, then they push the underlings and the runts to the front and make them take the front. But ordinarily, when cattle can move freely, they'll put the best leaders at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it appears that people who own a lot of cattle have told me that they will, if they lead them to pasture, if they're accustomed to the human, they'll follow the human when there's a herd, you know, change of pasture. You don't have to go out and round them all up with dogs and horses and so on and make them move. If you just go there and walk ahead of them, mm-hmm. they'll fall in line behind you. They assume the human is one of the herd, and
right.
they'll get behind you and follow you if you lead them to new pasture or water or whatever.
Right. That leader that they choose amongst themselves, as horses do as well, is very often a cow. And that's where you get the phrase lead cow from. And it struck me that cow sort of, in a way, chooses herself. She's the most assertive, it seems to me, or the one who seems to know where she's going.
Yeah,
it gets seems the others to follow.
Yeah, the uh-huh. one who's sort of an independent thinker and
right.
possibly hasn't led them astray in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it interesting that, yeah, this herd behavior actually conserves their energy.
Right.
They don't have to spend a lot of time fighting among themselves because cows are big animals and they need to eat a lot of grass
right.
every day.
Right.
So they spend most of their time eating, and mm-hmm. This herd behavior kind of makes it easier for them.
We should point out, I mean, there's so many things to bring into this. Cows are ruminant, as you point out, and in that they're big animals, they eat a lot. But another reason why we coexist so well is that they eat things we don't.
That's correct. And mm-hmm. many people are adamantly against cattle grazing or cattle on lands and figure that this is wrong, mm-hmm. that they're consuming what humans could be eating. Incorrect. Cattle eat materials we can't digest at all. And
right.
so in the proper proportion and the correct distribution, they're fantastic. I mean, mm-hmm. we work together so well because they can create the proteins that we vitally need.
Right.
From
sources we don't use.
Stuff we can't use.
Exactly. You mentioned a moment ago something about the nature of nomadic pastoral societies. And there's some really interesting material in the book on this. And leaping ahead somewhat, you make a point I thought about cattle cultures. It's very inclusive. Everything from the Celtic lands of Britain and Northern Europe to the West African societies, where you get essentially the same kind of social behavior among the humans who have cattle. And one particular point really leapt off the page, and that is that these folks tend to be, as you pointed out, able to pull up stakes, very resistant to authority, very independent-minded. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. it appears. And if you look at even today's politics today, you've got cattle culture. Of course, cattle cultures are driven to the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are on the periphery of their lands now and finding no control, no power, and fighting with one another, mm-hmm. fighting with the authorities. And it's difficult. The New World came just in time
yeah.
for the Scots and the Irish and so on to move into mm-hmm. the New World with their cattle. But
you'll be happy to know we're going to really focus on that, because I think that's a major turning point when we get that. I call it the Celtic diaspora and then the West African slave influence, and we're going to come to that in some detail. But on this question of the independence of these cattlemen and cattlewomen, I really saw echoes of rustling. You know, the kind of
yes.
which we have made as well, almost mythic thing about. And today, in our own West, where I think you have a different, almost political concept of relation to government than you do certainly on the East Coast. And I wondered if there were echoes of that.
Yeah, I've seen that in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, these people have been pushed kind of to the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
They're on very poor lands, trying to hang on to them, and they're losing, you know, our pastoral heritage,
right.
and they want to do what their fathers and grandfathers did, and you know they're very angry, and so there is a lot of distrust and
right.
animosity.
And it's interesting to see how rooted that is in something they may not even know about. I mean, this whole history, a tradition. You know, when I said at the outset that cattle have influenced language and culture, people might have said, "Oh, come on," but in fact, this is true. This is one of the most interesting things I thought in the book. And let's to focus on one of many aspects of this I found most intriguing. I think it's ancient Sumerian that's our first phonetic expression of language in the West, or at least one of them. And if I remember correctly, you make a point that the first two letters, Aleph and Beta, I suppose, mm-hmm. are strongly influenced by the cattle culture.
Yes, I was surprised when I discovered that the letter A is an ox head upside down.
I went back and looked
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. And so those first letters were really representative of cattle culture.
The second letter, beta, I think, is a tent, is it not?
Yeah.
So that, of course, would relate to the nomadic tribal. Extraordinary. Lori, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Lori Wen Carlson, author of Cattle, an Informal Social History, published by Ivan R. D. Now, Lori, to bring this story, which it proceeds literally through the ages, I mean, you come up through the caves, and there's an Indo-European aspect of this, an African aspect, a European, but eventually it comes to our shores. Shores of North America, particularly our country. And I think, and this is what I wanted to test on you, at this point, all these things seem to come together in an extraordinary way. For example, this Celtic diaspora and the West African cattle tradition meet in our own South Carolina, don't they? I mean, that's really where our cattle tradition begins, in the lowlands of South Carolina.
Yes, that's what they say. That's the hearth of the cattle culture in North America.
That would be, what, the 17th century?
The 1700s.
1700s, And what you have there are two disparate peoples, but linked by a common sense of how you raise cattle. Is that it? I mean, what makes it significant that we have the Celts and these Gambians, I suppose they are, the slave population, sort of working the cattle in the same way in South Carolina?
Well, I think they both brought some of the same things with them, and that was open-range herding and letting the animals roam freely to pasture and then rounding them up from time to time. And that was in contrast to what the English farmers did.
The English system was to keep a small number in a closely enclosed circumstance.
And so, very managed kind of system.
So what we're getting then in South Carolina in the 1700s in this free range is what I guess we with our cowboy tradition think of as real ranching, right?
Yes, I think that was it. That's where the real ranching started, and it was a fantastic place to raise cattle. They just multiplied incredibly, but were hit with disease, and we're not quite sure. It's interesting to look at these disease patterns and find that we're not quite sure exactly what it was that hit them or so on. But in the Carolinas, that was one of the things that pushed the cattle industry further away. And, of course, then plantation farming took up the lands and pushed cattle continued westward.
There is a very good depiction in the book throughout of the various ailments that affect cattle and the various commonalities, we might say, in ailments between us and cattle. And the effects of both of these things. But, you know, Lori, this business of starting in South Carolina, which I don't think few people would know about, but then moving to the West really does bring us, does it not, certainly in the post-Civil War 19th century, to what I guess is really the epitome of the free-range cultures, the cowboy era.
Right.
But you point out it's really very... It was just about 20 years, right?
Yes, it didn't last very long. It was essentially after the Civil War, and then when the buffalo were taken off the range and cows were moved north, and then it didn't last very long. There were too many cattle put on the range too quickly, and the weather was too harsh. Many of the investors who put them on the northern plains weren't even in this country. They were investors from England.
Right.
And it just too much... and not enough management of the cattle. And then we had the coming of barbed wire about that same time.
I was going to just turn to that, but before I turn to the barbed wire, that the American plains viewed from the perspective of cattle raising, I really think is like the crucible of the American experience in many ways. To the influences we've both been talking about, we had a strong Mexican and Spanish influence, did we not, Lori, in the strains of cattle coming?
Right. The longhorn cattle that came from Mexico.
Right. This is why the story really has layer upon layer of complexity, because once they began to ship those cattle, Lori, I got, well, several things were really influential. You mentioned fencing a minute ago, and as a technological initiative, that was of fundamental importance to the industry. Railroads, certainly, and then, of course, the city of Chicago.
Yes, Yeah, and Chicago stockyards, and of course that was really fueled once they figured out how to chill the beef, how to butcher and chill. Before that, they were sending live animals to the east to be slaughtered there. But once they came up with figuring out how to chill the beef with ice at first and then later refrigeration, then it made it possible.
What was Chicago? I mean, Chicago was just a question of location, as the real estate people say. I mean, it was just the right place?
I think so. Yeah, it was so where you could have the yards to fatten up the animals after you'd gotten them there from the plains or wherever you brought them in from. Then you could fatten them up on corn and make a kind of a tasty beef and then slaughter them there and then ship to points.
Was there some corresponding effect, well, put two ways, both on our national economy and influenced by it? What I'm thinking about is all of this also had to have a strong basis in changing consumptions of meat, did it? I mean, were more people eating it or trying to get?
Well, we had many more people coming into the country at that time. We had that surge of immigration to the industrial centers in the east. And, of course, we had to feed them. And, and this was part of feeding those urban centers. And as the dynamics in England at the same time were, they were hit by a cattle plague that wiped out their herds about this very same time, which fueled Chicago's meat market, because then we were exporting canned and chilled beef.
Everything, Lori, from free speech issues to scientific research has been touched by cattle. The free speech issue that you talk about in your book concerns a comment Oprah made a few years ago disparaging beef and got herself in big trouble. Because I suppose you explained it pretty well in the book, but there's legislation that does not allow you to what, defame a basic agricultural product?
Yeah, they call it veggie libel laws. Yeah, it's something new that came about a few years back. Several states passed this legislation, and it was promoted by the industries as a way to keep news accounts or any kind of upset in the news from affecting the markets of perishable products.
Right.
And it goes back to that Apple incident with Alar.
And
that was on 60 Minutes about the spray on apples, and then that devastated the apple crop in one season. And since many of these farm products are, you know, perishable, if the news account were false, if someone said something false and ruined the industry, it would be very unfair.
Right.
So you can agree with that point that, there's a problem. But on the other hand, it severely limits free speech by making people reluctant to even talk about it.
I think both sides of that are true. I did get a sense in the book how you can devastate an industry with a comment. On the other hand, it does conflict, at least, with our notions of the First Amendment.
Absolutely.
On the scientific end and medical end of the questions, you bring us to understand zoonosis. Zoonosis, do I pronounce it correctly? This is the diseases that can transmit between humans and other
animal and human diseases that we share, we pass back and forth.
Right. And of course, cattle have been very prominent in this part of the story, haven't they? And you bring us right up to date on this, and I would love to get your comment on this, on two of the most recent scourges, the mad cow disease. Now, how does that, even if it's a scientific question, Lori, even if it hasn't been answered, how does that possibly affect humans, the mad cow?
We're looking at it now. The experts are looking at it as a problem with cattle feed that has possibly been passed through cattle feed. It's not for sure. The jury is still out, but it seems to be that this continually turns up. Animals that were fed this rendered protein made from
other animals,
and other cows in particular, and possibly a few infected animals that have been turned into feed. But it still needs lots of research. But I'm thinking we may come up with, we're looking at something brand new with a prion theory that this may be causing it. And so this opens up a whole new vista.
Well, the disease in cows, it has a spongiform encephalopathy?
Yeah, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Yeah.
It's a long word, long term, but it struck me as the cow's brains that are literally perforated. I mean, little
holes.
Little
That's
holes
why they say the spongiform, because it's just covered with little tiny holes.
And our human version, we have something called Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob.
Jakob.
They say it.
Jakob syndrome, and disease rather. And there's the new version of that, the so-called NV version. is that where the suspicion arises that it might be related from?
Yes, because those hadn't turned up before. That particular type that turned up in young people had not turned up before until 10 years after the first mad cow was found in Britain. So about 10 years later, they started having incidents of young people with this disease where it had occurred in the past. It occurs naturally in about 1 in 1,000 people. So it's around, but it's usually in the elderly, and so not much notice is taken of it. But when it began appearing in young people, then they began to worry.
There are two worrisome things, aren't there, Lori? I mean, the fact that, first of all, it does affect the young, that's bad enough. But I also understood from your book that there's a very long incubation period, so our scientists may not be able to really understand this for perhaps a decade.
Yeah, it's a huge puzzle.
Yeah.
Right.
Another huge puzzle, or another big puzzle at least, is the foot and mouth.
Yeah.
And to relate that to very current times, it's a complex topic, but I thought one of the questions you at least raise in the book is its origins are still murky. And could it be related to, or could it become a form of agroterrorism? Is that one of the...
It looks like it could, as we looked at what happened in Britain. Of course, it will depend on the nation's response. If this happens here, it'll depend on how we respond. If we respond by slaughtering all of our animals, that's probably not the right way to go. One of the problems, that one of the reasons you become susceptible is by breeding up breeds of cattle that are not resistant to this disease. And this was known that Britain's cattle were not resistant, while cattle in other parts of the world, different breeds, are resistant.
Yeah, we're going to really touch on that, because one of the big points of your latter chapters are technological manipulation, if you will, of cattle and what that can, dangers that may pose. But on this same topic of the foot and mouth, There was, I mean, my own reaction, I think the reaction of many, was that it did seem almost medieval to destroy the herds in vast numbers. That you kept thinking there, in the 21st century, there should be some better remedy for it than that.
Well, there is vaccination. But the issue with vaccination is that Britain wouldn't have been able to sell this meat on an international market.
Because the vaccination couldn't be detected?
Because, well, no, countries that vaccinate are known to have the disease. Oh. And so if you vaccinate, you are restricted from selling in certain markets. Your people can still eat the beef, which is the saddest thing, because Britain imports about exactly as much beef as it exports. So they could have called it null and void and simply just, you know, begin vaccination. But it was an international trade issue is really what it was, and not so much an animal health issue, because other countries do vaccinate.
Exactly. On the more hopeful side of the human-cattle relationship and its impact on medical science, we have the wonderful story of Edward Jenner and his use of cowpox as a source of, and vaccination actually comes from vacas and cows as a word, as a remedy for smallpox.
Yeah,
that's really quite a heartening thing.
It is. The story of Jenner and his experiments and what he discovered and the fact that he realized what he discovered is fascinating. It's one of the big success stories in medicine.
Yeah. There are a lot of wonderful stories in this book on the scientific end. There's a fellow, is it Bakewell?
Yes, Robert Bakewell.
Robert Bakewell, who breeds species with extraordinary skill, I think, in the 18th century in England. And then there's this kind of remarkable story from our own century of, in Germany, in Munich, I think, the successful breeding back to the aurochs. I mean, that just boggles my mind that we were able to breed the species all the way back to its original, prehistoric huge beasts.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the story that went behind that and how they mixed breeds, because cattle, there are so many breeds of cattle. It's almost like back after the Paleolithic era, wherever cattle distributed themselves, they almost were in little pockets and valleys, and each one kind of became its own separate breed. They were isolated, and all the breeds developed separately, and so there was a wide range. And what they did in Germany was try to recreate these extinct animals. The last wild cow, which was called an aurochs, was 1620 maybe in Poland, I think, was the last one that was seen. And so they thought they would try to breed back and see if they could create one of these wild beasts.
And they did,
by mixing some of these strange breeds from different parts of Europe together.
Wow. And Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it is. Uh-huh. It is very interesting. Yeah.
You take a real issue toward the end of your book, Lori. I mean, two things actually here. There's a diet controversy surrounding beef, and I think you present an interesting side point of view on that. And also you raise a real personal concern over cattle raising techniques today. And talk to both of those points. First of all, the thing about the diet controversy. It seems to me there's some very strong suggestion in the book that beef is not the villain that it's been depicted.
That's what I discovered. I was a vegetarian for many years and figured that was the way to health. Mm-hmm. And after I've done some more research on protein and diet, and of course now with this beef research, mm-hmm. I've discovered that there are some things in beef that just really aren't in everything else, and they're essential, unless you can supplement your diet with lots of fish or other particular things. It's the easiest way to get a lot of iron, mm-hmm. and a lot of the amino acids that you need, a lot of these omega fatty acids, is with good quality beef.
Right.
And that doesn't mean beef that's just raised being fed manure or ground up other animals. It mm-hmm. means eating beef that are raised on grass.
And you are concerned about what beef are being fed, aren't you?
That's right, because mm-hmm. we consume them. We depend mm-hmm. on this species of animal, and some of the food stuff that's being fed to them, mm-hmm. they've become our garbage pit, and we recycle a lot of industrial waste back into cattle feed and think mm-hmm. nothing of it because it solves a lot of problems.
But this to you and for all of us then is a real issue.
It is.
Today.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think we should be more aware of what we're eating and almost revere it more than we do.
Mm. Well said. Well, Lori, I really enjoyed the book, and you can see I read it.
Yes, yes.
Right through. And in coming to the conclusion of the conversation, as I came to the conclusion of the book, I was trying to say, well, to paraphrase my own mind, the kind of central message you wanted to get out. And I'm going to certainly ask you what that is. I must say, as a reader, I was struck by a word I used earlier, and that is interdependence, that, you know, we're not masters of the planet so much as we're interdependent with it. But you should have the last word. As the author of this book, which was inspired by your early visit, I think, to an animal fair,
yeah.
What did you want to accomplish? What do you want readers to take away?
I think more of a reverence for life of domestic animals as well as wild, and also the idea that cattle cannot be machines.
Lori, the book is Cattle, An Informal Social History. It's a very good book, and I'm happy to recommend it. Thank you for being my guest.
Thank you, George. I'm delighted.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Lori Wynn Carlson, author of Cattle, An Informal Social History. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is presented by PRI Public Radio International and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146.